Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bobby O'Hill.
And Janine Wishy. I actually have red hair, so,
you know. I don't have any.
I know you don't have any.
But I am Irish. My great-grandma came from Ireland. So
I think on my mom's side, there's a lot of Scotch-Irish sort of mutt, European mutt.
You got a wee bit of the temperament, too, lass.
Probably, yeah.
Yes, I'm nervous from time to time. Yeah. Not that I know.
Well, working with you, I'll give it to you.
I'm here to practice your
that
Irish dander.
Major sedation.
That's right.
One extreme or the other, right?
I got you.
So you're back from Ireland and other fantastic places on your summer holiday to Europe. So we look forward over the next couple of weeks to listen in on some of the excitement.
Yeah, I did a couple things in Ireland I hope to share with the listeners here in the next week or two. Began at the Blarney Castle, of course, and it's kind of redundant for me to be at the Blarney Castle, but I do seem, from a sense of myself, more eloquent, more thoughtful, and my diction is better than it was when I left.
Because well, that's good.
I know, it needed improvement. Uh-huh. I did kiss the stone, which is about the size of a big zucchini, actually, when you get there, and it's cemented to the bottom of this, like a little well, and you have to lay on your back and lean way back and kiss the stone. But the yard, the grounds around the thing are amazing.
They are beautiful.
They're mystical, and they've added a lot of things. There's a lot of Blarney to the Blarney Castle. But
excellent.
I had a great time. I spoke to the head gardener there, a woman named Tanya Payne. Excellent guide, and I'm looking forward to sharing it with the listeners.
So that's coming up in part two of Homegrown today, so stick around. We're also going to talk with Cynthia Napek. She's the executive director of Brightside. I mean, honestly, Bob, just to get a more comprehensive view of Brightside, I think most people have no idea, unless they're actively involved in them as part of their volunteer force.
Or worse, they take it for granted.
I think most people do, in fact, take it for granted.
And they don't understand what funds it and all the work involved.
Yeah, and the reach they have. I mean, you know, for example, they work with TARC.
Right.
To keep the bus shelters clean.
Yeah.
You know, and Cynthia was telling me that some of those bus shelters are cleaned twice a day because people just throw trash down, even if there's a trash can. So, you know, it's that balance of, okay, if we didn't pick it up, then would people maybe realize that, you know, they need to pay attention, or they just assume that, you know, somebody's going to come pick it up. Well, those people that are helping facilitate that are TARC and Brightside. And we'll talk about the other collaborations that exist and how you can get involved with this sort of quasi-nonprofit
It makes such a difference in the town.
Yeah,
it
really does.
Yeah.
For, over 20 years now. So we look forward to Cynthia, our conversation with Cynthia. She'll be coming into the studio here in a little bit. What's going on in your garden?
It's kind of an odd kudo to the hackberry tree. We've talked about it from time to time.
I love my hackberries.
Yeah, but it started losing its leaves in late August, which they do. They come on late and they leave early and they're on the ground. It was kind of a warm-up for fall, and I kind of somehow, in a strange way, appreciated
that. And it's definitely not, like, good fall color or anything. They
No, but it's just a sturdy, kind of like, I guess, like Brightside, kind of sturdy. It's there. It's unappreciated.
Mm-hmm.
Great shade tree.
Mm-hmm.
And the
beautiful
fact that it led the league in first leaves to fall, I kind of like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it's like I'm home from Ireland, and there were some leaves on the ground.
Yeah. Mine usually gets nipple gall.
Oh, yeah.
And that may be part of why the leaves drop a little early, too.
Yeah.
I don't know. So, but I agree. Kudos to the
hackberry.
The lowly
unappreciated hackberry. How about the Wish Estate? What's up?
The molt has begun. The chicken molt.
Oh, no.
You know, I mean, they do it every year. This time it starts sooner or later with the chickens. They start to molt. And like when it first starts to happen, you panic because you think somebody's getting harassed.
Yeah.
Because the first feathers to go are the ones right here on her neck.
I know the feeling.
And then this morning when I let them out in their day secure area, one of them had lost all her tail feathers.
Does this mean no eggs for a while?
Well, they do stop laying eggs if they molt dramatically. And like that's the thing. Some of them molt a lot, and then some of them don't molt at all, and some of them molt a little bit. But it has begun. So if you did get chickens this year or last year and you're starting to see some like feather droppage, and it usually begins on the inside of the neck and then the tail, don't freak out because it's totally natural. chickens don't keep their feathers forever, right?
Absolutely.
Sort of like how you molt, but fortunately, they do actually grow back.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
I'm fully molted, just about.
Bob, let's get to the calendar because there's a bajillion things going on. Yeah, it's the whole September gardening thing. Nothing in August, and then bam, it starts again in September. First thing, Friday, September 11th. And then Saturday, September 12th, Drop Seed Native Plant Nursery is having their fall plant sale. They have one in the spring. They have one in the fall. For details about, you know, where they're located out in Oldham County, go to our website. We can provide a link to Drop Seed Nursery. But great native plants, tall prairie grasses, that sort of thing. SIBS, the Southern Indiana Botanical Society's yard and plant sale. Bob?
Yep, that's Saturday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Mount St. Francis up there in the Knobs.
September 12th. Also yep. September 12th, Bernheim.
Bernheim is having a plant sale. It's a day-long extravaganza with plant sale and a band and come talk to the gardeners. It's a great time to visit Bernheim the 12th from 9:30 until they throw you out.
Until they throw you
go
out.
Go buy a plant.
Also, plant sale at Whitehall on Sunday the 13th. Again, all the details, information on our website at WFPL.org.
Yeah, of course, Thienemann's is always busy with things to do. They're going to have an English trough workshop on Friday, September 11th and Saturday the 12th, 10 a.m. Friday and 2 p.m. Saturday.
No excuses this fabulous
oh,
weekend.
Oh, man, it's a great weekend.
All right. Moving on, while you're out there enjoying nature, also take note of maybe a little trash that could be about or the things that you can do to volunteer or get involved.
None that I left.
Yeah, not me. Absolutely not. But if you're not sure how to get involved, you will be after our conversation with Cynthia Napek. She's joining us in the studio now to talk about Brightside. She is the executive director of Brightside. I think a pretty recognized name in Louisville, but I don't think everybody really knows what they do, so we're going to try to hash that out today. But Brightside's original incarnation was Operation Brightside. It was started 20 years ago to address community beautification, and one of their signatures, of course, was the all the daffodils that are planted along the highways as you enter downtown Spaghetti Junction. Always look forward to that in the spring of the year.
I do, too.
And they revamped that just recently as well, so that's good. But Brightside's been committed to doing much, much more than that over the years, and Cynthia's here with us today to talk about that. Cynthia, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you all. I'm really excited about talking to you today.
Good. The goals of Brightside originally, in the beginning, focused primarily on what, and then we can sort of hash out how it's evolved over the years, how it's grown.
I think that the goals of Brightside, when we started in 1986, were similar to the overall goals that we have today. We just go about it a little bit differently. In the early days of the program, it focused on the urban core, so the original city limits, and it was about cleanup, mostly neighborhood-based cleanup, and encouraging people to get out and clean their own block.
So cleanup, basically picking up litter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then also beautification, but a lot of the beautification work was focused on neighborhood subdivision entrances, and that we did a lot of work with neighborhood groups in that direction. And then also, of course, you mentioned the beautiful daffodils. Mm-hmm. That was one of the early projects that everyone got to know Brightside through. Mm-hmm. But today, we are taking on more ground in the fact that we're an entire metro area now.
Right.
So it's not just the urban core, but we're working to get out into the suburbs so that people who weren't necessarily familiar with us before merged government are now working with us. So we're taking on more of that. And then we're really focusing on our ability to be a catalyst and our ability to provide people with the tools to do it for themselves. So Brightside is not the neighborhood cleanup crew.
We get especially a lot lately.
So we cannot come remove the flood damage stuff from your basement. You know, and we still get a whole lot of phone calls from people who want us to come out, and they say, oh, you know, can't you send a Brightside crew out to clean up this area or that area? But really what we do, you know, when we get those phone calls, then we talk to people and we say, what we can do is, if you are interested in this area being clean, then we can help you organize a neighborhood group to go out and clean it up. Mm-hmm. We provide people with the bags and the gloves and help empower them to be able to do the good work in the community. Brightside has a fairly limited staff. We only have 8 people. A lot of people think that we have 80 or...
Well, part of the confusion came back in the day when the Brightside logo was on waste management trucks and that sort of thing, which kind of created confusion because people thought that Brightside was their trash pickup.
Yeah, that's a great observation. And, you know, you were asking about then and now. Mm-hmm. So then, when the mayor first started Brightside in 1986, he thought it was a great program and he really wanted people to know it was being created.
So the logo was plastered
so
everywhere.
The logo went everywhere. We put the Brightside logo on all of the city vehicles, particularly the garbage trucks. Uh-huh. And so then
kinda
people...
shot yourself in the foot, huh?
Yeah, we got an A-plus for PR and maybe a not quite so good grade on communicating what we do.
The mayor's logo is all over town, too, at that point. So
you know, I guess if it worked to win an election, then it must work to kind of promote a program.
Yeah, it wasn't on the garbage trucks, I don't think, however.
Yeah.
Well, Brightside addresses these goals in many different ways, through neighborhoods and schools and businesses. So let's talk about some of the programs specifically and how they work with these different factions and groups.
Mm-hmm. One of the things we were talking about is that Brightside really likes to expand our reach by empowering other people. So the different groups that we work with, we work a whole lot with the schools. The schools are one area where we really try and get into the classrooms and help engage the next generation of environmental stewards. So that starts as young as preschool. We do some preschool education, but we have a great focus on our third graders. We have a wonderful award-winning program called EcoDrama. It's done in partnership with Stage One, and it is an amazing blend of environmental science and drama. So these third grade students get to spend a week with a Stage One resident.
Oh, wow.
And they get to pretend that they are the recycling rangers. Uh-huh. And they get to pretend that they are engaged in being a planet protector. Uh-huh. So we start there. They take those lessons home with them. Then we build on up to a middle school and high school program that we call our Youth Summit, where we actually bring these students together at the University of Louisville. And they talk about how to create a greener campus. And they don't just talk about it. What they're actually discussing is what they did. And Brightside works with them to actually put a plan of action together for what they can do to create a greener campus. And so that's kind of that's one piece where we work with school groups. But then you had asked about other groups, and we also work with neighborhood associations. Neighborhood associations come to us and say, we really want more trees, or we really want our subdivision entrance to reflect that this is a nice place to live. And so through different programs like our NatureScape grants, we offer neighborhood groups both advice and a little bit of seed money to do whatever project or program will really help beautify their piece of our community. Mm-hmm.
So your 8-member staff really reaches out to literally hundreds of people before you're done. How many volunteers do you think you have at the max?
Well, we just looked at our numbers from last year, and I think we had about 22,000 people who volunteered with us.
Wow.
Over the years in some form or fashion.
Absolutely. Okay. Oh, well, no, not over the years, but...
Over the one year.
We had about 22,000 people volunteer for us. A lot of those were cleanup volunteers. Mm-hmm. So when you think about it, if we had not organized all 22,000 of those people, then that's either
trash.
All that trash would still be out there, or we probably would have had to fund public works crews going out. So we save the city, we save your tax dollars by organizing all these cleanups and getting people out there to keep our streets free of litter.
Mm-hmm. Bright Sites, another sort of, I think, kind of neighborhood component, at least, where you can come to a stoplight and look over and see beautifully planted medium. What's the status of Bright Sites these days?
Bright Sites are a great program that has definitely gone through some transitions over our 20-year or 20-plus-year history. We used to actually run the Bright Site program as a volunteer initiative where we would have volunteers out in the bright sites. We have found that some of those areas mm-hmm. are not really the safest place to send volunteers.
Right.
So we actually have moved the Bright Site program to more of a program where it's engaging our corporate citizens. Mm-hmm. So each Bright Site is sponsored
by... So we'll send the businessmen out there, but not the community volunteers.
Yeah, that's right. Right.
But they can sponsor these sites and then they can be taken care of professionally.
Right. Yeah. Well, and actually, we take care of them. We okay. Bright Site utilizes work release inmates, mm-hmm. which is a really interesting program. It provides folks that are getting ready to be released back into our society mm-hmm. the opportunity to develop some career skills. It provides Bright Site the opportunity to beautify our medians without having to hire on many crews of people. Mm-hmm. So it's really a win-win program. The money comes in from businesses to sponsor it, and we are able to take these gateways from one part of the city to the next part of the city mm-hmm. and really kind of create something there that is beautiful and makes you smile on your way to and from work or home.
I know Bright Site has been involved in some collaboration with the highway department with their wildflower plantings and native grasses and that sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about those collaborative efforts to beautify? As you said, you know, it's no longer the urban core, but it's really spreading out.
Yes, absolutely. We do work regularly with the Department of Transportation to make sure that our interstates look beautiful. And it's a huge job, I have to say. It is absolutely a huge job. When you're driving past at 65 miles an hour, you really don't get a good concept of exactly how much land is out there. Mm-hmm. So it takes a whole lot of time, energy, attention, and funding to do interstate beautification. But we have two or three programs that we have done with them where we're looking at how to make those interstates seem welcoming and reflect well on our city. With proceeds from one of our large fundraisers, Gallapalooza, we were able to plant wildflowers along the Gene Snyder. So we have wildflowers that stretch from one end of the Gene Snyder to the other. The other thing that we've done is on some of the ramps mm-hmm. that people get from point A to point B, like right around Churchill Downs, we've done some rosebush plantings. Mm-hmm. And we have programs kind of in the pipeline, if you will, right around the airport and the fairgrounds so that when visitors come, they are introduced to the city in a very positive way, whether they're flying in or whether they're coming to the fairgrounds to see a regional show. So we're working on all sorts of things that hopefully will impact our city, both from just the visual aesthetic, but then when you do those kinds of things, it ripples and it has positive influences on economic development and the ability to bring people here and for them to say, oh, this is a great place. I mm-hmm. definitely want to be in this city.
So it begs the question, Cynthia. I mean, you know, if you think about just that one collaboration that you spoke of in terms of highway beautification, the funding that's required for that, the costs that are involved in maintenance, and, you know, you want things to be sustainable. There's all kinds of challenges, really. But bottom line is that it costs a lot of money. And you all are set up as a nonprofit, and I don't think people realize that as well. You're set up as a nonprofit primarily with some support from Metro government. So how do you fund yourselves? How do you make sure that there are enough dollars to go around so that you can support community education and neighborhood, you know, nature scape grants and that sort of thing?
That is a great question, because I do think that a lot of people don't really know exactly how Bright Site functions. Some people think that we are a government agency and receive all of our funding from the tax base. You know, probably other people think that we're entirely nonprofit, and the truth is we're a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. We receive a little bit of operating overhead from Louisville Metro government, and all of the rest of our program money is raised privately through sponsorships and individual donors. So each program may have a corporate sponsor, and then it also may have folks who want to give $25 or $100 or whatever to send us. And that's really how all of our programs are funded. Recently, we have received a significant reduction in the funding that we receive sure. from mm-hmm. Metro government, which means that we are now really trying to reach out to our donor base, connect with them and say, you know, how can we communicate more what it is that we're doing in the community so that people will feel inspired to offer us a little bit of support.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you give us an idea, a rough estimate of what your total budget is and maybe what percent comes from volunteers and in-kind services and those kind of things?
Sure. Our budget is somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million, give or take. This year, I think about 20% of that, maybe a little less, comes from government.
Wow.
So the rest of it?
Not much.
No.
For the work you guys do.
Yeah, absolutely. And the rest of it all comes from, you know, individual folks. And that actually doesn't really even count
the volunteer hours,
yeah, which is significant.
Mm-hmm. You guys have engaged in quite a few significant fundraisers. And you had mentioned Gallapalooza from several years ago, but you guys are in another round of Gallapalooza. Talk about sort of the phenomena, really, of the horses.
Yeah,
and, of course, it's a beautiful fit for Louisville, of course, because it's horses. But you know, talk about Gallapalooza and all those great horses out there.
Yes, we love the Gallapalooza project. It was a wonderful fundraiser for us when we did it 5 years ago. A lot of people can't believe that it's been five years, but it's been 5 years ago. And it raised a whole lot of money for Brightside. And it raise money for other charities as well. So
that's right, yes.
It was a wonderful program for the community, not just because the end result, raising money for charity, but because everyone really, really loved having the horses on the streets.
Yeah.
So over the last few years, we've received hundreds.
Yeah. Do it again.
Yes,
do it again.
Hundreds of requests to do it again. And, you know, so we just kind of waited until we had everything lined up and we felt like, you know, we could support another round. And right now we have the horses on the streets and they will go to auction in November.
Okay.
So that is at the auction. That is one of the ways that we will hopefully raise money for some of these projects that we've got going on. And if anyone is interested in owning a piece of Gallapalooza history, if they feel like a Gallapalooza could find a fabulous home in the lobby of their building, in their backyard, you know, wherever it is that they want to put
in their neighborhood
exactly.
entrance.
Yes.
You do see them in really funny and funky places.
Yeah.
You really do.
You do. And 100% of the proceeds go back to Brightside or go back to programs that are done in partnership with Brightside for beautification. I think one of the projects that Gallapalooza is looking at this time around would be to do some beautification around the airport and fairgrounds that we were talking about earlier. So
it also engages the Louisville arts community, which is a very strong group in itself. So it's a nice combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been able to bring in at all like the Louisville Nursery Association or the Kentucky Landscapers in terms of getting plants and ideas and drawings and so forth?
We've done a little bit of that. I think, you know, definitely we always invite additional partners, more partnership. So anytime someone is interested in doing more with us, we are very interested in that.
That would seem like a natural partnership, too. If some nursery or somebody would just join in and say, this is our corner. You know, Audie did this, or Thieneman did this, or somebody else did this. It might be nice for everybody.
Do you think they're listening right now? Maybe?
That's why I'm saying it.
Because that would be
wink.
A great idea.
It would be. Sure, this is the Audie nursery.
Wallach has been involved in the past with the flower shower, right?
Yes. So. Actually, several of our local nurseries have donated and been involved with us in various capacities. So yes, we're very fortunate to have many in-kind partners.
Mm-hmm.
The other big fundraiser that we do benefits downtown beautification, and it's a really exciting program because it also engages our young professional community. The Green Tie Bash is done in partnership with the Young Professional Association of Louisville, YPAL, and the Louisville Urban League, and they plan it, put it on, help us raise the money. They come out and have a good time, and the proceeds have gone back into, for those that are downtown, you might have noticed all the beautiful pots that are planted, and the proceeds from the Green Tie Bash go to fund those pots. And we always are looking for people who want to either help with sponsorship or want to come and have a great time. buy some tickets. It's usually in March every year.
Well, and I think that's a good example of any kind of collaboration can take hold.
Oh, sure.
That, you know, the Green Tie Bash, the young professionals can have fun, be involved in Brightside and furthering that mission, which then beautifies the community. And, you know, it just, so any organization,
yeah,
really, any group
is what it is.
Could collaborate, yeah, with you all in any number of ways.
The green ripple.
Do you?
It is a green ripple.
Yeah, there we go.
I like it.
That's the next one.
You can
That's
have
the
it.
Next.
Thank you. Uh-huh.
I'll attend that one next year.
Okay.
Cynthia, ultimately, what is it that Brightside wants to see people do? I mean, you know, just that first step, I mean, I guess just kind of contact you all and find out what resources are available, get involved somehow, spread the word. I mean, what is it? Pick up the piece of litter you see on the sidewalk when you're walking down the sidewalk?
The answer is yes.
Yes, 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 and yes.
The thing that Brightside does really well is about engaging citizens. If we received a whole bunch of money and could just afford to go out and do it all on our own, mm-hmm, it wouldn't necessarily serve our mission.
Right.
Our mission is really about getting lots and lots of people engaged so that we all get a sense of civic pride,
sure,
and
ownership of that,
exactly,
nice green space.
You got it. So all of our programs are designed to get people engaged. Okay. So we would encourage people to go to our website, which is brightsideinc.org. Mm-hmm. There's always great volunteer opportunities on there, so you can find out about how to get involved in community cleanups. We hope that when you participate in one of our programs, that it will change the way you behave, the way you view our city. So 2 hours spent on a cleanup, it's amazing how people go from not even really seeing or noticing the litter, mm-hmm, to taking ownership of that street, and then,
absolutely,
they will stop and pick up the litter, mm-hmm, and really be a part of the solution going forward. So I think that's really what we hope for. Obviously, we hope everyone will write us a little check and, you know, say nice things about us and do all those things. But as far as fulfillment of our mission, we hope that everyone will engage in clean and green.
All right. Thank you, Cynthia. We appreciate it.
Excellent.
Thank you, guys. We really, really liked being here today.
Great. Cynthia Napek is the executive director of Brightside, where their mission is to help us all stay focused, involved, and educated on being clean and green in Louisville. For more information on their programs, volunteer opportunities, or to be a donor, please visit our website at wfpl.org. And, of course, a quick reminder that the school deadline for applications for the Fred Wishy Award is fast approaching, so you'll want to get those in soon. If you don't already have one, you can call Brightside at 574-2613.
Coming up next, I get to talk about kissing the Blarney Stone and talk about the plants found at this famed castle in Ireland. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bobby O'Hill. And, of course, Homegrown has been to New Zealand and Hawaii and Costa Rica, Wales and Scotland and England. And this is probably the worst Irish accent you're ever going to hear, folks. But there's a reason for that. I'm at Blarney Castle in Blarney, England. And it's a wonderful place that people think about the Blarney Stone all the time, but not the 70 acres of gardens around it. And, of course, I'm going to kiss the Blarney Stone later as if I needed to, but it's the home of eloquence and it must be done here. But it's probably, and I've been to gardens all over the United Kingdom and over the world, really. This is the most enchanting, likable, and magical garden I think I've ever been to. Part like a South American jungle, trees 500 to 600 years old. They're working on a poison garden here, of course, which is necessary in Ireland. Some waterfalls that are manufactured, but you don't care. They're so beautiful. Druid caves, witches' stones, a perennial border up along a tall stone wall they're working on. A fairy glade and, of course, a sacrificial altar. This is, after all, again, Ireland. And here to explain all this is Tanya Payne. She's the head gardener at Blarney Castle in Blarney, Ireland. And Tanya, welcome to Homegrown.
Welcome, Bob. I hope you enjoy your visit.
How about some background first? How does somebody get a job like this at Blarney Castle?
Well, I was actually a chef for 10 years before I became a gardener, but my parents have a garden centre up in Wicklow, and I was always doing a little bit on the side, and then I decided to have a career change and go back to college, and I did horticulture in the Botanic Gardens in Dublin, and this was the first job I got when I left, and I'm here ever since, 9 years.
And you can tell her accent's a whole lot better than mine, so I'll leave mine alone for the rest of the interview. But the castle itself, let's talk about Blarney Castle, and then we'll get to Blarney Stone. Blarney Castle.
Well, Blarney Castle was built by the McCarthy kings. I'm sure there's lots of McCarthys in America. And it was built in the mid-1400s. And the Blarney Stone is right at the very top of the castle.
And the history of the Blarney Stone, there's some information, of course, outside, and says that it goes back to Queen Elizabeth, who was unhappy with a member of the McCarthy clan because she wanted something from the clan very badly, and he said nice things about her, but it never amounted to anything. So she said of him, "This is all Blarney. What he says, he never means." And thus the word Blarney was born.
That's right. That's where the word Blarney comes from. But the actual stone itself is supposedly the stone that the Scottish kings were crowned on, part of the Stone of Scone. And it was sent over as a present to one of the McCarthy kings for sending soldiers to fight in a battle with the Scottish against the English. And the kissing of the stone comes from those days where people would have paid homage to the stone the kings were crowned on. They would have kissed it. So that continued when it came here then. People thought it was good luck to kiss it.
Indeed, and I'll find out. My eloquence may improve 100%, not that it needs it, but even today I'm here. It's a fairly busy day in August, and there's tour buses coming in from all over the world. So the lure of the Blarney Stone is just incredible.
That's right. It's actually one of the top 10 tourist attractions in the country, and it's just up there with Ayers Rock and the Eiffel Tower and the Statue of Liberty. People just feel it's something they must do. It's apparently on the list of the top 100 things to do before you die. So you'll have to join in them and do it as well while you're here.
It's on my bucket list. And have they got the elevator built to the top yet?
Unfortunately, no. There's 106 steps, so you want to be fit.
Okay, let's talk about the gardens themselves, and there's so many dimensions to it that... But we'll break it down first. There's some wonderful old trees. Now, people in the States, when they say yews, they think of often the ornamental plants that go as foundation plants along their sidewalk. There are yew trees here that are 400 to 500 years old. They're just hard to believe.
Yes, they're a native species. The Latin name, same name worldwide for the tree, is Taxus baccata. And every part of the tree is poisonous except for the red berries, which birds can eat. But obviously the seed is poisonous, but that comes out the other end, so they're okay. And our oldest yew trees here are about 400 or 500 years old. Now, they can live to a much older age. The oldest one in Ireland is 1,200 years old. It's in Wexford. It's here at the time of the Vikings' invasions. And they have much older ones in England. But we've got the largest grove of ancient yew trees in the country.
And it's hard to put your arms around, literally around some of these trees. This is a yew that, you think of in your front yard. But you give them 500 years or so, and they want to get a whole lot bigger than that. And then there's the close, which is really the magical and enchanting part of this garden. And part of it, as it turns out, is Blarney. It's not quite as old maybe as you think, or a little bit manufactured. But you don't care, because it's just got some wonderful elements to it. Let's start with the waterfalls, these wonderful water. The water just pours out of the top of rocks from the side of a hill.
Yeah, it's lovely to have the sound of water in a garden, and so we've put in these two waterfalls. It was a German man, Manfred Baer, who actually engineered them for us, and they look completely natural. They're fed actually naturally by the ponds, but there's just a series of little jets in behind the rock, which creates the waterfall and the water curtain.
And as you walk around, there's a Druid's cave and a Druid's circle, which date back maybe a couple thousand years, but they actually have some basis in fact. So tell us about the Druids here in Ireland.
The Druids were an ancient Celtic people. The Druids were the priests of the ancient Celtic people, and they worshipped elements of nature. They based their calendar on sacred trees, and there's evidence that there was a Druidic settlement in this particular spot in the rock close at Blarney Castle, and that's why we have the Druid Circle.
And it's a circle of rocks, and it's the kind of rocks I like because they look just worn by time and nature. They're not quite jagged, but they have holes in them and little peaks and valleys that are just kind of fun to touch. Then there's the Wishing Steps, which is a whole story unto itself.
The Wishing Steps date from the mid-1700s when the Jeffreys family, when the castle fell to the English, the Jeffreys family bought the castle and they built a house onto the front of the castle and landscaped the area around the castle. And the Wishing Steps date from that time of landscaping when they built these Wishing Steps.
And then there's something fairly new in the garden here. You've got this 4-acre enclosed garden wall. It's just an astounding sight to see. And someday you have hope to have that open to the visitors, but right now it's just a place where you've got a few beds started and some cows. But talk about that incredible enclosed garden.
Well, it would have been amazing in its day. We used to think that it dated from the present mansion, which is separate from the castle and was built in 1874 when the Jeffreys family intermarried with the present Coldhurst family, who are the owners today. And we thought the wall garden dated from that house, but actually it dates from the house I was previously talking about, which was built onto the front of the castle in the early 1700s. And it would have been used to grow all the fruit and vegetables for the family that were living here at the time. But it just fell into disrepair over the years. Labour costs got higher and vegetables started to be imported. So the garden actually fell into disrepair, but we've been gradually restoring it with the hope to open it to the public. But with the recession now, I don't know if that's going to happen.
Well, one wall that is open to the public is a herbaceous border. It runs along, must be 100 metres or so, it'll be 100 yards in the States. A very nice mix of herbaceous plants up against the wall where their backs are protected, so to speak. Tell us about that. How do you pick the plants for herbaceous borders like that?
Well, actually, that herbaceous border faces south, so it's an ideal location for growing those plants. It's in the sun all day, and we decided to pick all hot colours as a theme. And because we're kind of low on summer colour here, it's a spring garden, there's a lot of rhododendron, azaleas and bulbs, we decided to just concentrate on picking flowers that suited a sunny spot and that flowered June, July, August, September. So that's why it's a blaze of colour. It'll just be a blaze of colour now and then it'll be finished for the winter. And we tried to pick things that didn't need too much staking just to keep the work down. And it's actually a repeated pattern, 15 metres and then repeated again another 15 metres. I think with herbaceous borders it always looks nice if you see a repeated pattern because it just ties it all together. And also because it's so narrow, it makes it look a bit wider doing that.
And not too far from the sunny herbaceous border is a fern garden. And I walked through there, it was just like prehistoric. There's these monster ferns, some 15, 20 feet tall, and they only grow an inch a year. So these plants were put in a long time ago. It's like you're looking for dinosaurs in there.
Yeah, the fern garden is interesting. I'm sorry, I don't mean to correct you there now, but it's actually quite new, the fern garden. The concept was thought of in the 80s when Sir Harold Hillier, the famous nursery in England, was a friend of the family here, and he went for a walk in the gardens and found this dell and said it would be really suitable for a fern garden. And a couple of years ago, we had a gardener start here, Adam Whitburn, and he was really interested in ferns, and he went looking for the dell and found it, and we decided to develop it into a fern garden. And the ferns, mostly those big tree ferns that are really old, have been imported from New Zealand, but they've been taken from areas where they were going to be cleared for roads or housing, so they haven't been just cut down just to bring here. And we have the tallest tree fern in Ireland, which is 17 feet high, which is quite impressive. So because we put in these older ferns, we actually created the atmosphere, which is good because you actually fell for it. You thought it was there for years, which is what we were trying to do. And there's a lot of native ferns in there. And we actually have 80 different kinds of ferns in that garden. And it is a lovely, lovely place to visit.
Another really wonderful thing is a boardwalk you've put in here. It looks, again, it seems tropical. It just doesn't seem like Ireland. You could be in so many places besides Ireland, but there's a long boardwalk with these great big plants, gunnera. The leaves are like 5-6 feet across, and maybe the plant may be 18-20 feet tall, it seems like, in some places.
That's right. Everybody's always very impressed with the gunnera. That actually is here before I came. It's a South American plant, and that's 1 year's growth that you see, which is quite amazing. It dies down completely in the winter, and we leave the leaves on top of the crowns of the plant just to protect them from the frost, and then it comes back up every year. But that was quite a wet area, and we decided to put in that boardwalk so that people could walk through there, and it's just another element to the garden. I think the most interesting gardens are gardens that have a lot of variety and different atmospheres and different elements. So the boardwalk, you're kind of walking through the plants, which is nice, and it goes past the two waterfalls that we previously were talking about.
And then the lake, at the back of the estate, there's the Blarney Castle, then there's the home here, the Blarney House, I guess it is, and the back behind that even is a large lake that's been here like forever. Tell us about the lake.
That's right, it's a naturally occurring lake. I mean, Blarney Castle is set in kind of a valley, so the water naturally drains into this area where the lake is. It's 12 acres wide. Apparently it was widened by one of the owner's previous ancestors, And they say there was a brick path around it then, which got buried then when they widened the lake. There's a family of swans on it, and it's stocked with fish, and there's a lot of nice wildlife around it. You can walk all the way around the lake. There's a couple of nice walks on the estate around the lake and through the woods, and there's a lovely view of the lake from the house.
And this is a working estate. The owner lives here in Blarney House a great deal of the time. Blarney House is opened in the spring, so describe a little bit about the owner and the house itself.
Well, the present owner is Sir Charles Colchurst. He's the 10th Baronet. He's got an inherited title. The Colchursts intermarried with the Jeffreys family, who owned the castle previously, and the Colchurst family built the present mansion in 1874. The present owner was born here and educated in England, and he lives here and manages the estate. He's got four children, one boy and three girls.
One other thought. We were driving around, and I got a nice tour, and we were talking about working in a place that's been alive and well for 400 or 500 years. So what's it like working in a garden like this, in a castle like this, in a stone wall like this, where you're literally following the footsteps of hundreds, if not thousands, of people before you?
It's amazing. I mean, I'm often like just weeding in the beds, and I'm thinking of all the people who went before me and what was here before. And what's nice is that some features, like the old walls and everything, have just lasted through time. I mean, obviously plants have changed, and you know, different things have been grown, but I think the atmosphere has stayed the same, and you know, the history is still there, and it is an interesting place to work.
Have you seen any leprechauns at all around here?
I've seen lots of tourists dressed up as leprechauns. Does that count?
No, I don't think so. Well, thank you. It's just been a glory to be here, and I hope that people will listen to this and head straight for Blarney Stone and the garden the next time they come to Ireland.
That's right. I mean, a lot of people don't realize, even I didn't realize when I came for my interview here for the job, but the extensive gardens there, where everybody knows Blarney Castle for the stone. And it was never really promoted with the gardens. So it's great that, you know, you're getting the message out there now that it's worth coming to see the gardens in their own right and not just coming to kiss the stone.
Tanya Payne is the head gardener at Blarney Castle in Blarney, Ireland. I took a lot of pictures here, folks. So if you want to see this place, go to our website, wfpl.org.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I am Bob Hill with a couple of questions.
Are you clean and green with a couple of questions?
I am.
All right.
First one's for you, because this is another one you know something about and I don't know much at all.
Okay. So there.
Yeah, it's from Rose. Great name for a question. I love the little golden pear tomatoes, but have little success with them in my raised bed or in a pot on the patio. As soon as the fruits first appear, the vine starts to die. Any suggestions would be most welcome.
I'm thinking two things.
Okay.
She's raising them in a raised garden, right? A raised bed.
That's what she says.
Or a pot on the patio.
Mm-hmm.
And if she plants these in the same area year after year, every year she's going to probably increase the incidence of disease in the soil, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Rose, what you really should do is try to find a different place to plant the tomato in the ground. And if you can't, then make sure you put some new soil in a very large container. And, you know, basically, containers are tricky with tomatoes, especially cherry tomatoes, because they're cherry varieties, you know, and pear varieties. They're so vigorous, their root system becomes extremely vigorous. So if you kind of thwart that vigorousness of their of their root system, the plant can suffer from some decline. If you miss a watering, if you don't fertilize it enough, you know, it's kind of hard on it. So I suspect she's got some sort of soil-borne disease pathogen there, so she needs to, in theory, rotate.
I got you.
Okay.
Another question, Miss Wishy, from Betty, my mom's name. Is there a camellia that is hardy in the Louisville area?
Yeah, there's a ton of them.
Yes, there are.
And they were developed out of the National Arboretum several, you know, like I want to say in the 80s. So it's a sure thing now. They've been around long enough. But Dr. Ackerman, a pretty famous name up that way, they crossbred, you know, one known for hardiness and one known for flowers, and came up with these Ackerman hybrids. And you'll basically, Bob, the key is shop at local reputable nurseries, because they would not carry a camellia that would not be hardy here, right? and the names suggest their hardiness. So you've got like frost something.
Yeah, exactly.
Chili something and iceberg something. And, you know, anything that suggests icy, cold, whatever is the hardy.
And it would help to put them against the south-facing or east-facing wall, too, I think. An open, exposed area where the west or when you're north, you're taking your chances.
As long as you're they're protected from the west, I think you're in pretty good shape. So,
and they are so much fun when they bloom and you get that fragrance.
Yeah,
oh, my
cool.
goodness.
Yeah. Okay, here's a question from James. Hello, okay. I'm looking for a good shade tree to act as an umbrella for a patio area in a small Crescent Hill yard. It needs to be about 20 to 25 feet high and be able to be limbed up to create headroom underneath because it's going to be planted next to the side of the patio and then trained over it. If it was something that produced some food product, he would not be opposed to that either. So food for birds or food for him, I'm not really sure, right?
Right.
He says that he does have some redbud volunteers that he could move. And he's trying to layer some Japanese maples. Would these be good options?
I think the redbud volunteers would work. I mean, it takes a few years. They grow pretty quick. Mm-hmm. The Japanese maple, he might be 80 years old before it gets enough size.
Yeah, for sure.
Not necessarily a good one to use. But one I thought of that would provide food for everybody could be the crabapple.
Mm-hmm.
You get the color and the crabapples. Right. And
but you want to get the right
cultivar,
cultivar. And we have some prairie fire that are perfect umbrella-like trees. One of my favorite trees that's woefully underplanted, the Amerimachia or Machia amarensis.
And I don't,
it basically looks like a small locust, you know. Summer blooms, so you'll get bees, which are pretty cool, I think. But that it's that perfect size, and it's that perfect arching umbrella habit. So they're out there.
Be the only kid in your block with a
Amerimachia.
Whatever you say, kiddo.
Exactly.
If you have an Amerimachia for a question or Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
The fall blooming crocus.
Uh-huh.
Not the colchicum.
Oh, I was going to say colchicum.
No, it's not. I was going to say that too initially, but then I did some research.
Did your research. Good.
I saw this plant actually in a package in Ireland, and I think I've tried it here already. It's the crocus sativus or sativus.
Sativus,
Yeah, it's the saffron. It's where saffron comes from.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that. And of course, saffron, as you know, is the most expensive spice in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's But as luck would have it, I saw these in Ireland at the nursery. It's not easy to grow here. Mm-hmm. You plant it in the fall. You can plant it right now.
Mm-hmm.
It'll bloom in October, the same year, and then it'll come back next year maybe. That's the tricky,
That's
the tricky part.
It's almost like an annual bulb.
Well, it needs a hot, dry climate and good drainage.
Which we don't have in the winter.
But, sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. It's got this beautiful, fragrant, deep lavender, purple-veined flowers with these long scarlet stigmas, which is where the...
And that's the saffron.
Yeah, right. It can be plucked and dried to make saffron, but it can take 250,000 stigmas to make 1 pound of saffron.
I know. That's why when you buy it, you basically buy like this much of it.
The word crocus is Greek for saffron, in fact.
Oh, is it?
And saffron is Arabic for yellow.
Huh.
We're covering the globe here.
How about that?
And sativus means cultivated or sown.
Right, I knew that.
So it's a native to Greece or Asia, where it became a cash crop. It goes back to 1500 B.C. Used for fragrance for Roman women to dye hair and to color their cloth yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Monks used it as a gold leaf for painting. It was a collateral for loans and jewels in the 15th century.
Huh.
Men were buried alive as a punishment for messing with the saffron.
Mm-hmm.
They took it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Pops up in the Old Testament in the Song of Solomon. It's used to heal everything from rheumatism to measles, as a hangover cure for depression, and a salve for jaundice. Here's the recipe for the jaundice. An ounce of saffron, a quart of earthworms, and a peck of snails.
How about that? After you eat that, you won't care if you're jaundiced.
No. And of course, it'll flower the first year. It may not come back, but it comes with a poem.
All right.
If it's new color you want, here's a can't miss. Go find a package of Crocus sativus. And here's the biggest surprise of all. This one will actually bloom in the fall. When the tulips and daffodils are all long gone, here comes the lavender saffron. with fragrance that will reduce you to tears, and a history covering thousands of years. Offering paint to the poorest monks, and recovery to the loudest of drunks. Need a curative for all that ails? Try saffron, earthworms, and snails. A tiny flower for the strongest of kings, it flew the world on biblical wings, allowing merchants to earn in the millions. It's so easy, just planted by the billions.
There you go. Very good. Thank you, Bob.
Yes, ma'am.
Very educational. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, more of Ireland and Wayne Winter Road and Joe Eck's new book, Our Life in Gardens.
Homegrown is produced by the perpetually green Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.